Well, the Supreme Court, U.S. Supreme Court's been in the news lately. A couple of significant cases. One just decided here. It takes somebody with significant experience to talk about it. So Derek Aistrike is with us here today. But this first case, the court issued a ruling regarding First Amendment speech. This was involving a ban of counselors being able to even talk about conversion therapy for minors. In other words, you can talk all day long about changing your gender, but in Colorado, the state legislature said the thing you can't talk about is changing it back. That didn't make a lot of sense, did it? And the Supreme Court ruled 8-1 that, yes, that does not make sense. That is a censorship. And then also, the birthright citizenship, citizenship clause of the 14th Amendment, what's in that? What will be impactful in that? Derek Aistrike now joins us, chief legal counsel for the Montana Family Foundation, director of government affairs as well. It's montanafamily.org. And Derek, good morning, sir. How you doing?
Good morning, Tom. I'm doing really well. I hope you had a happy Easter. My family, we really enjoy the Easter season, Resurrection Sunday, and I'm doing great.
Good. I'm glad. And we did, too. And I hope everybody availed themselves of that opportunity, of that gift of salvation as well. Derek, so, you know, there's probably more out there that I should have my eye on, but I wanted to talk about a couple of these key Supreme Court cases. And this one was an 8-1 decision, and I've read enough about it to understand, Justice Jackson Brown's, Ketanji Jackson Brown, yes. Brown Jackson, thank you. I don't get that right, to understand the dissent there. But for me, why don't you run into this and then tell us, the ruling here and what the impact is?
Yeah, no, and I'm sorry, Ms. Jackson, but the court ruled 8-1 on March 31st that a Colorado law, and look, Tom, a lot of the laws and these challenges, you think about the very famous bake shop, cake shop case that went all the way up to the U.S. Supreme Court that came out of Colorado.
Yeah.
We have several of these cases all the way up to the U.S. Supreme Court. This is yet another one. This Colorado law, as applied to this counselor's talk therapy session, the Supreme Court ruled that it regulated speech based on her viewpoint. And so the U.S. Supreme Court reversed those lower court decisions and sent the case back down. Justice Gorsuch wrote the majority. It's an 8-1 decision with, as you mentioned, Ketanji Brown Jackson as the only dissenter. And so really what the court said here is that content-based speech restrictions are presumptively unconstitutional, and viewpoint discrimination is an especially serious First Amendment problem. So why this matters? It's not just about counseling, because I think it's more of a broader warning that states cannot suppress disfavored viewpoints merely because the speaker is a licensed professional. So just because the state considers a Christian worldview disfavored for some reason, they can't suppress that biblical worldview simply because they offer a license to an individual. So big implications beyond just this context. So wherever government tries to police what professionals say in one direction and not another, this case has some application. Government can regulate malpractice, right? But it can't impose ideological orthodoxy by deciding which conversations people are allowed to have and which they aren't.
Yeah, and let's get into that a little bit, because this is one of those things where we point to, if the world's upside down, here's an example where the state of Colorado, encourages and even in some ways without parental notice encourages gender transition amongst minors.
Right.
Then when there were counselors out there who started saying, well, there are kids having issues with that, and it's called conversion therapy, back to the sex of their birth, that you can't talk about that. Didn't that just strike people? What's the conversation? Why did Colorado do this? It just seems like it's such a one-way street to bad moral policy.
Well, and I think why Colorado did this is several years back they passed what we call a SOGI law. So in our code in Montana, for example, we have certain classes of individuals that you cannot discriminate against. That's based on age, race, marital status, nationality, et cetera. Mm-hmm. Well, what Colorado and some other states have done is they've added sexual orientation and gender identity into that list of classes of individuals. And that's caused a whole host of problems. But at the end of the day, when you have a state law that prohibits discrimination based on certain specified classes going up against the First Amendment, which is in our U.S. Constitution, the Supreme Court said, your First Amendment rights don't disappear in a counseling office. I think that's the important thing to keep in mind here is that's really the genesis of a lot of these cases, is that when you have these state laws that add in these kind of made up classes, frankly, it leads to this whole host of problems.
How impactful is this? I mean, the ruling said discriminated based on viewpoint, but to me, it has broader, much broader applications. And give your thoughts on it, please. It was a bellwether decision about how we going to approach, gender dysphoria going forward too.
Yeah, well, and there are several other cases too that we could talk about. Mirabelli v. Bonta was another recent one. But the other thing to keep in mind is this is not a narrow decision. This isn't a 5-4 or a 6-3. This was an 8-1.
Yeah.
With even Justices Kagan and Sotomayor joining in the majority. So it tells you how serious the Supreme Court considers this speech problem. It's our First Amendment for a reason. And you have a right to express your viewpoints and your worldviews. And the government does not have a right to suppress them, or even if they disfavor your viewpoint, they can't suppress the words that you use. And so I think it's, like you said, this is a bellwether. This is a very important case moving forward, especially for licensed professionals, because you have a property interest in your professional license, your law license, for example, your medical license, for example, your counselor's license, like here in Colorado. And just because you have to be accredited or go back to the state and re-up your license doesn't mean they get to control the sorts of speech that you engage in.
How does it,
so very important.
Yeah, thank you. How does this affect free speech at the pulpit? We have seen attempts, certain legislators, blue states, that are trying to claim that, Christian advocacy is hate speech. And they've had some success in some courts, which is not surprising the way our courts now are. Does this impact that movement going forward?
I would think so. I think it has some bearing on that. I mean, we've also seen some movement on the IRS side of things. For example, we had an IRS ruling recently, and forgive me because I don't have the citation off the top of my head right now.
It's okay. It goes in one ear and out the other. So
But that being said, the IRS had some. I would say there was some uncertainty from the pulpit as to whether or not you could discuss political issues or discuss candidates or discuss elections from the pulpit. And the IRS cleared that up, that you're not jeopardizing your tax-exempt status as a church by engaging in that sort of discussion from the pulpit. And so, you know, in line with that and in line with the Childs v. Salazar case, I would say that, you know, applying this more broadly, as I think it should be, you know, pastors especially should be free to speak the truth at all times. In fact, I think they're called to do that. And the truth sometimes discriminates. It discriminates against falsities, and that's what the truth does. So, I understand that there has been a push from the left in particular to kind of label a certain speech hate speech. There's been an attack on the First Amendment itself in recent years, and we've seen how that's played out. With the assassination of Charlie Kirk, I think is a grand example of somebody who stood for that First Amendment right, and that was the whole basis of his movement. And the left labeled it hate speech, and because they labeled it hate speech, they considered it violence. They wanted to equate the two. Hate speech equals violence, and therefore we can engage in physical violence as a response. I think that's the ultimate goal. And so the more cases like Childs v. Salazar and other cases make their way up to the Supreme Court, it just reconfirms that, you know, you can engage in your First Amendment right. It actually is not equal to physical violence, and speech should be protected in this country.
Great. I appreciate that. I mean, you're right. They're trying to build those blocks up to create a wall for our abilities to speak freely. And it's one of our grandest freedoms.
It's the first.
Yeah.
It's the first. And, you know, it's often said that we have the Second Amendment to protect the First Amendment. But you know, this is the foundation of our country.
Yes.
Is being able to engage in free speech.
That's why it seems so odd. And then I've read a lot of criticism about Justice Jackson's dissent on that. And you could tell, I won't even go into it. What I'm curious about now, before we take this break, is when the Supreme Court sends a decision back, for further court action, what do they expect? What can we expect from something like that?
Well, I think what we can expect from something like this is that the courts will obey the rule of law. This is, you know, foundational to our system of justice. So when the Supreme Court sends it back, you can expect that the lower courts are going to follow the marching orders, and that any case brought before a lower court in Colorado related to this law and related to a professional license where somebody is claiming, no, they can't engage in that sort of speech. They can't talk about their faith. They can't talk about their biblical worldview. They can't tell me that there are only two biological sexes. That's discrimination against me. We can expect that the lower courts are going to rule consistent that no, they actually have a right under the First Amendment of the U.S. Constitution to engage in that speech. Just because you don't like it, you know, go to a different cake shop or go to a different counselor. That's your right as well.
Even in Colorado?
Even in Colorado. That's the hope, is that they would follow suit.
We're talking about the Montana Supreme Court, not Montana, pardon. But this is U.S. Supreme Court stuff today with Derek A. Stryker with the Montana Family Foundation. He's the chief legal counsel there and director of government affairs, montanafamily.org, for more information. Earlier, it was an 8-1 decision that defended our free speech rights. I didn't understand this, Derek, but 22 states have some laws out there restricting conversion therapy for minors. And I just find... you know, the misdirection on this policy I can't fathom it because it seems like it's pretty clear. This next one, though, is more of a complicated case as well, and we'll talk about history and intent and all of that. Yeah. The Birthright Citizenship Clause. Talk about that one.
Yeah. So this is a very interesting case.
Yeah.
So let's start at the start, right? So can a president like Donald Trump end birthright citizenship simply through executive order? Donald Trump issued an order trying to deny the automatic citizenship to children born on U.S. soil if their parents are either in the country illegally or in the United States on temporary visas. And so really what this is a direct challenge to our 14th Amendment, which, you know, if we're being honest here, has long been understood to guarantee citizenship to almost everyone born on U.S. soil. And so that's, you know, this is where we get the concept of a few years back, we heard anchor baby as a term that was thrown around, you know, people that would come into the country to deliver their child on U.S. soil and then have what they would call an anchor baby. And so we've had this understanding for a long time. The case itself, I think, turns primarily on one phrase in our 14th Amendment, which is, quote, subject to the jurisdiction thereof, end quote. And so the Trump administration is arguing that this phrase excludes children of non-citizens, especially those children that are here with parents that are here unlawfully or temporarily, and therefore those children are not automatically citizens. And so the challengers, on the other hand, are turning to U.S. Supreme Court precedent, the United States v. Wong Kim Ark, which is a case that they argue is directly on point. And they basically are saying that this phrase has been settled for well over a century. It basically means anyone born on U.S. soil is automatically a citizen with some very, very narrow exceptions. So what's happened so far is the executive order that Trump issued has been blocked by multiple lower courts. Those courts have said that this executive order is likely unconstitutional. The Supreme Court agreed to hear the case, and we've had oral arguments so far. And frankly, during oral arguments, it appeared like many of the justices were very skeptical of ending this automatic birthright citizenship from our 14th Amendment.
Yeah, and that's a lot of people's take on that. What can change from that take, so to speak, analysis of oral arguments to when they deliberate this issue?
Well, I think what the justices are going to have to wrestle with is you know, we have this principle of stare decisis, and so the, you know, we've had, just because we have a case from, you know, 100 years ago or 50 years ago, doesn't mean they have to follow that precedent. But typically, when you have this principle of stare decisis, courts are compelled, most of the time, to follow their precedent. And so you have this United States v. Wong Kim Ark, that's pretty well on point. And the court is going to be reluctant, I would say, to overturn this sort of precedent unless they have something, you know, some clear basis to do so. And we've seen that, you know, an example would be the Dobbs decision that overturned Roe versus Wade. You know, this is potential, but it's rare. You have a textual and a historical problem here. The 14th Amendment, we've understood it the same way pretty much since 1868. So overturning that understanding, I think, would require a lot of rewriting of that long settled constitutional interpretation.
Yeah,
the practical consequences too that I think the court is wrestling with is if you adopt the Trump administration's argument, you're creating this kind of permanent class of non-citizen children born in the U.S. So you're going to have a lot of legal questions there, like, well, what citizenship does this child have, if any?
Yeah.
If it's born on U.S. soil, you have, let's say, parents from each from two different countries, both here unlawfully or temporarily. you know, to which country does this child belong? I think that's a tough question to settle for the U.S. Supreme Court. And then you have at the heart of it too, a separation of powers issue. Mm-hmm. And we have to think, you know, moving forward too, if it's wise to have precedent on the books where by executive order, the United States president can override a constitutional amendment,
yeah.
an amendment to our Constitution.
Yeah.
Is that wise? And so that's another question that the court is wrestling with.
Yeah.
You know, because remember, we might not always have a Republican president.
Pretty sure that so won't fly. I'm pretty sure that, yeah. you know, that aspect in and of itself. So folks are going to have to look to Congress to rectify this issue more effectively, more permanently, I should say. And I think it's become yeah. necessary because we're seeing a lot of abuses in that birthright citizenship provision. I got 2 minutes.
Right.
I got 2 minutes left here, Derek, and I don't want to. I know you've got like a new building you're breaking ground on.
Oh yeah.
So I want to talk about the Family Foundation. Yeah, let's roll into that.
Yeah. Thanks so much for giving me a little time to talk about the frankly one of the most exciting things in the history of the Montana Family Foundation. We're thrilled. Just yesterday we had some heavy equipment on the property just two blocks from the state capitol in Helena. We've already broken ground on this project. We're constructing a three-story, 10,000 square foot, vertically integrated hub for Christian policymaking right here in Montana, right here in Helena. And we're just thrilled to see what God has done since we announced our project in October. We've raised over $6 million toward building this Montana Center for Christian Policy, and we're just thrilled and amazed and excited. So I'm thank you for giving me some time to share. And if people are interested to find out more and take a look at the artistic renderings of what the building's going to look like, and if they feel led to contribute, they can visit our website at montanafamily.org and see all about our building project.
Congratulations on that. And I think it's a good sign.
Thank
I don't
you.
Have much time to talk more about it, but I feel a quickening. And I feel this, you know, in response to things like that, too. And I'm glad because we need citadels of truth. Going yeah. forward in our world today. Derek Astreicher, Montana Family Foundation. Be well. Happy yes. you know, Eastern time to you and your family, all right?
Thank you, Tom. Likewise. Thanks for having me on.
Thanks for joining us for the podcast. And join us weekdays live from 9 a.m. to 10 a.m. for more Voices of Montana on great radio stations all across our Treasure State.